Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nachtigall, your host. For today's program, I just interviewed Professor Michael Langlois. He earned his PhD at the Sorbonne in Paris. He also teaches as an associate professor at the University of Strasbourg, and he's a world-renowned epigrapher. We spoke to him about the Misha Stela, what he's done a lot of work on over the past decade, particularly in relation not just to the whole inscription, but to a part of the inscription that he believes says the House of David. So this is a really important inscription that mentions the biblical king starting a dynasty and ruling from Jerusalem. And so for today's program, we're going to cut away to him. I'm here in Edmond, Oklahoma, where we have this exhibit, The Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered. He's in Paris, and we are talking about the Misha Stela. Professor Michael Langlois, thanks very much for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So you've been studying ancient inscriptions for some time now, and of particular note for us is the Misha Stela inscription from the 9th century and your work that you've done on that. We have an exhibit behind me, The Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered, and this inscription, it features partly in the exhibit. We don't have the Misha Stela with us, but we have a nice picture of it and part of the translation. But I wanted to have you onto the show so that you can speak to your research about the Misha Stela, its significance. And so first of all, for the uninitiated, please tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your history in this field, and then we'll get into just the background, the historical setting for the Misha Stela.
Yes, sure. So my initial training is in mathematics and computer science, and then I studied theology and then history and archaeology with a focus on biblical archaeology. So my main research is to study ancient inscriptions that relate to the Bible, both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. And I try and use modern technology to help decipher inscriptions. Sometimes we have like new inscriptions. I'm working right now on ancient Hebrew ostraca that have never been published before. And I also study anew some of the most famous ancient inscriptions that relate to the Bible. And so the Misha Stela is one of them, of course.
So we'll get to these unpublished inscriptions that you're working on. That sounds very interesting. But if we can go straight to the Misha Stela, and perhaps you can give a bit of background as far as its discovery and its where it was found, and then also some of the difficulties that arise, particularly with this artifact in its understanding what it says.
Yes, the story is amazing. So it was discovered in the late 19th century in Jordan, modern day Jordan, in Diban, we don't really know who first heard about it. There's a pastor from Alsace, from the eastern part of France, which was actually part of Germany at the time, who apparently was visiting the Holy Land and heard about this inscription, and then he told about it to a number of scholars in Jerusalem, especially a French scholar named Clermont Ganneau, who was quite young at the time, and quickly realized the significance of this inscription. But it was difficult to locate the inscription. It was with the Bedouin tribes in Jordan, and very quickly the Germans, the British, everybody heard about it. They wanted to have a piece of it. At some point, the inscription was even broken into pieces. There was already a transcription that had been made. So even if even though some pieces are still missing today, scholars were able to reconstruct the stele. And it's very significant because it's the earliest attestation of the name of God, the Tetragrammaton. And it's also one of the earliest attestations of the name of Israel, the fact that there's a kingdom of Israel. And even now, this is my own contribution. I think that there's also a mention of the House of David, the dynasty of King David, which is also a very significant discovery.
So in terms of the location, this is modern day Jordan, the ancient area of Moab in the biblical period. And as far as the dating of the inscription, when is it dated to? What period?
So the inscription itself is thanks to the inscription itself. The name of the king, King Mesha, is actually mentioned in the Bible in the 2 Kings chapter 3. So we know the time period, and we know it's from the 9th century BCE. And it's actually very interesting because, you know, very often biblical characters are not mentioned anywhere outside the Bible. So some people would even doubt their existence. They would say, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, King Mesha of Moab never existed because he's not mentioned outside. And of course, it's always difficult because there's so little that we know. I mean, you can imagine the size of the Holy Land, and we haven't excavated only like a tiny percentage. So it was a very important discovery because it was the stone itself was made by King Mesha of Moab. So we know it's from the late 9th century BCE. And it does mention the dynasty of Omri in the kingdom of Israel in the north, the kingdom of Judah. So it correlates a number of facts that we had from the Hebrew Bible, especially the Book of Kings, but were not attested outside of the Hebrew Bible. So it was not found during regular excavations. Also, anyway, you know, in the 19th century, it was right. Long before what we call archaeology today was right. Born. So we had explorers. But of course, you know, nowadays when we do excavations, every piece is documented. We have photographs, we have sediments that we take that we can analyze. We do radiocarbon dating. All of this did not exist at the time anyway. So the main way to determine the date of the inscription is the text itself that tells us about King Mesha.
And then I guess it's the style of writing. I suppose what language is this written in, and what's its
Yeah, so the language, well, we call it Moabite because it's from Moab, right? The kingdom of Moab is mentioned in the Bible, and it's located east of the Dead Sea, you know. So if you have the Dead Sea, you know, what we call Transjordan, the Transjordan area, on the other side of the Jordan River and of the Dead Sea, you have cliffs and you have mountains, and it's where the kingdom of Moab was located. Now, the language itself is very close to Hebrew, actually. There's no real reason from a linguistic standpoint to call it a different language. I mean, people could understand each other. They may have a different accent, and maybe some of the words are a bit different. But, you know, this happens in any language, like even modern day English. You right. would say that people, if they are in the UK or in the USA, you know, the language will be a bit different. The dialect, we would say, is a bit different. Some of the words are not the same, but the language itself is more or less the same. And it's the same thing. So the stone is the inscription is in Moabite, but if you studied ancient Hebrew, you can read it very easily. Now, the shape of the letters is a bit unusual. Actually, it was unlike anything that we had seen before. I mean, it's the same alphabet, 22 letters that we have in Phoenician, in Hebrew, in Aramaic. So the alphabet is the same, but the shape of some of the letter, like the length of some of the strokes, the inclination is a bit unique in that regard. Some of the letters of the alphabet are really interesting, actually.
So in terms of comparison, if this is the 9th century, the other famous inscription from the 9th century discovered in Tel Dan in the north of Israel, and this was written in Aramaic, but you're saying the style between those two, even though they're very similar, probably written within the span of decades, I guess, of each other, they're different, those two?
Yes. Yes, they're different. So it's the same alphabet, the same 22 letters. So the overall shape, I mean, you would recognize, of course, if you've studied ancient Hebrew and Aramaic, of course, you would recognize the letter. It's a bet, it's a mm-hmm. resh, it's a, right. Yeah, that's okay. But, you know, there are some specific features, especially the vav and the samech. I mean, some of the letters are a bit different. And the language, of course, is different because the Tel Dan inscription is in Aramaic. Right. And Aramaic is a different language than Hebrew or Moabite.
Right. Okay. So again, this inscription is amazing. Just as in terms of all the details from the biblical period that it really does mention. You mentioned the name of God, Omri. And then it also mentions the tribe of Gad, which is just really fascinating in itself, since they were somewhere over in this territory as well. Let's get to the meat of the controversy over this inscription, the infamous line 31 of it. And perhaps you can tell us about the debate before you got involved into what it says, the difficulty in reading this line specifically as well.
Yes, so the difficulty lies in the fact that the stone was broken. So there are a number of pieces that are missing, and they're still missing today. But before the stone was broken, there was a squeeze that was made on the stone itself. So we have the squeeze is in Paris. And that's the basis that was used actually to reconstruct the stone. If you look at the stone today, which is in Paris in the Louvre, you know, in the museum there, you will see ancient pieces and also modern reconstruction. So line 31.
What do you mean by squeeze? If I can interrupt you, what do you mean by squeeze?
Yes. So the squeeze, you take some kind of a plaster, a thin a sheet that looks a bit like plaster, like fresh, and basically you apply it on the stone. You wait until it dries, and when it dries, you can take it off, and you have an imprint basically of the inscription. So that's the idea of a squeeze, and that's a technique that's been used for quite some time, for centuries actually. Of course, nowadays we would use modern tools like RTI or 3D scan, and you know, but back then, you know, that's what people would do, and it's quite easy to do actually. So that's what we call a squeeze. So the squeeze itself is basically an imprint of the inscription itself. So we have the squeeze, but the squeeze again is not perfect, because the young boy who had to do the squeeze had to leave before the squeeze was dry. So there are some parts with the squeeze we're not really sure, and that's the case of line 31. So already in the late 19th century, when there were a number of transfer proposed for the inscription, especially by Clermont-Ganneau in France, but by Ginsburg in London, and also some other people in Berlin. So there were a number of scholars who proposed to a reading of the inscription. And at line 31, no one agreed on what letters should be read at the end of the line. They disagreed on it, but if you take each letter individually, there's always like one of them said, oh, this could be a Dalet, this could be some other letter. And no one suggested that if you put them all together, you could read Beit David, which means the house of David, the royal house of King David. But actually the letters were there. Among the suggestions, they said, oh, this could be this or that. So you have a number of possible combinations, but no one thought that one of the possible combinations was to read the House of David. And this was suggested first by another French scholar, André Lemaire, in the 1990s, just before the discovery of the Tel Dan inscription, actually. He submitted a paper proposing to read the House of David. And of course, shortly afterwards, the Tel Dan stone was found, and there the reading is clear, but David is clear on the Tel Dan inscription. So this confirmed that this was a possible reading, but somehow a number of people refused to accept this reading. It was, of course, not sure, because again, the stone is in bad condition at that point. So I thought, you know, when we celebrated the 150th anniversary of the discovery of the Mesha inscription, I decided to use modern techniques, especially RTI, to see if I could get a better reading of this line and other lines. Actually, I wrote a paper with a number of elements on the stone, you know, whose reading was unsure, and among the different things that I tested, I looked at this line and I concluded that the two possible readings that made sense in the context and with the shape of the lines are either Beit David, which means the house of David, or Ben David, which is son of David. In any case, it was a way to designate the king that was ruling at the time. Either calling him like a son of David, a descendant of King David, or someone from the house of David, which means the dynasty of David.
Yeah, I think this is a critical thing that you bring up, is the fact that Lemaire really came to this reading prior to the Dan Tell Dan Steeler, which everyone agrees nowadays, unless you're extremely fringe, that the Tell Dan Steeler says House of David references a dynasty of David. And then he came forward with this reading of exactly the same letters that he said were on the Misha Steeler. And from that standpoint, there wasn't an inscription that said House of David yet. And then the very next year, the discovery is made that very does verify his initial reading. Yeah. I want to take you to a paper that was written in 2019, if I can. This is a paper that was written by Israel Finkelstein, Nadav Naaman, and Thomas Romer. I've got the title here. I won't do it from memory. That's a bad idea. The title of the paper was Restoring Line 31 in the Misha Steeler, the House of David or Biblical Balak. I remember this coming out. I read the paper and then it seemed like almost immediately you had a rebuttal already prepared. Did you know about what they were saying, or did it just happenstance that it came out?
No, so I gave a paper in 2018 about my findings with the Misha inscription. We were in Jerusalem at the time, and so my paper was ready to be published, and this is when their own paper was published. And so I just had, like, I think a few days before my own paper was already fully written, so I just added a footnote somewhere in my paper to say, oh, by the way, they are publishing their own paper on there. But I didn't have time to properly respond to their paper. But I thought that my own analysis was anyway quite conclusive, so I didn't need to go into too much detail. To make it simple, they made a very, very bad mistake, is that they looked at the stone itself, and a part of the stone that is reconstructed, that is, it's a modern plaster that they put on the stone, and they look at the stroke and say, look, there is a stroke that says it's the end of the sentence, because one of the elements of the syntax on the Misha inscriptions that sentences are separated by a vertical stroke, which is quite unusual even at the time. But anyway, so they said, look, this is the end of the sentence, so we only have three letters, so we then what can we read? So this is their main mistake, to think that, and this vertical stroke is not on the stone itself. It's part of the modern reconstruction of the stone that you can easily see if you go to Paris, or even if you look at pictures of the stone. Anyway, so this is a, and then secondly, even if you look at what precedes, and again, the letters that precede are not visible in the stone itself. You need to look at the squeeze, or you need to look at you need to look at the squeeze, basically. And there, the angles, there are a few traces of angles. And again, in my paper, I tried, you know, I'm a mathematician by training, so I do things systematically. I looked at every possible stroke, every possible letter, every possible combinations, and really balance is not one of them. There's nowhere. Well, of course, yeah, you can read the beta at the beginning, I agree, but then reading a lamed is very difficult, and a kof is very difficult. And then balak, what I found amazing is that, you really have to, how to say that? It's really not natural. Reading balak doesn't make sense. And also, I think it's quite interesting to see that scholars who complain, you know, want to read biblical names everywhere outside of the Bible, they are doing the same thing, because basically Balak is not mentioned anywhere outside the Bible. So it's almost as if, you know, they would rather read any name except David. You know, it can be whatever you want. It can be Balak if you want, you know, even a king that, you know, for all we know is only mentioned in the Bible, and following their own line of argument, I could say, well, as far as I'm concerned, Balak never even existed. He's a purely fictional character because he's only mentioned in the Bible. I'm not saying that's what I'm saying, but this is usually the typical argument by minimalists who would, you know, disregard any biblical evidence because they're not mentioned outside the Bible. But anyway, so they would rather read a name, Balak, of a character that is only mentioned, you know, in the Bible and only once, rather than what the shape of the letters leads us to conclude, you know. And again, when I read, you know, the letters, I didn't even try to read only David. But the thing is that when you have Danet, Vav Danet at the end, you know, I look for any possible other reading. And in my paper, it appears. I'm like, you know, the bet at the beginning could be a preposition, but then you have a name with four letters.
Right.
Could it be a foreign word? I mean, I really tried very hard. I did my best to come up with something else than David. I wasn't trying to push for reading David there, but that's the only possible reading. So I was really sad about their paper. And actually I spoke shortly after the publication of their paper. They hadn't consulted me before they published their own paper. And it's bad because I had the RTI photographs. I could have given them, we could have shared our research. And I spoke to one of the people from their team, a student who had been working with them. And I told him, he himself felt bad. He said, no, I know you're right, but they wouldn't listen. It's really, it's sad.
Yeah, it doesn't help also that every one of these authors prior to this publishing of this paper for the previous 25 years had been on this kind of crusade, if we can call it, against David. I'm reminded of Yossi Garfinkel's excavations at Caiapha, where he came out as a 10th century site. Okay, everyone agrees then it's a 10th century site, the time of King David. But then everyone piled on with different ethnicities, and it went down Philistines, and then it's the Canaanite, and then it's some other, you know, ethnicity we'd never even heard of. It's like anything but Judah. And then somebody said, okay, it's not King David, it's actually King Saul. So again, it points to this idea that we can back up the Bible with our ideas, but anything but David or the Davidic dynasty.
Yeah, that's a very good example. I remember also reading that, oh, it's King Saul and not King David. I'm like, again, I mean, okay, so now Saul is a historical character, because I thought, you know, from what they usually say, like no one existed, you know, all of this is purely fictional. But when they are happy with it, then they're happy to say that, yeah, it can be King Saul. Maybe King Saul existed, but not King David. So, of course, we need to be more nuanced about that. But you're right. I mean, I think it's, you know, we're trying to do solid scholarship and to look at the facts and say, and again, when the Tel Dan inscription was published and we have Beit David, oh, what does it mean, house of David? And they had plenty of other explanations. Again, we have this, it's a common phrase, and we have the house of these, the house of that. If it had been any question, you read the house of someone, it's the name of designates the dynasty of this king. And we have this in Akkadian inscriptions, in other inscriptions from the same time period with other kings from other kingdoms. And so if it's a kingdom of Damascus or any other place, it's okay. So again, I can tell that everybody, there are tensions just because we're talking about Jerusalem, we're talking about David. If it were any other place, any other name of any other king, it would be okay. It would be fine. But that's when I see that there's people are not objective. They approach this with we need to be as objective as we can be, you know. And I say, you know, there wouldn't be such a controversy if it were. So it's indicative of the fact that people really, they don't want it to be David, right? They want to find an excuse for it not to be David when, you know, I'm just doing science and like, okay, that's what the facts tell me. So again, you don't have to believe everything the Bible says about David. Everybody, I mean, faith is something different, right? So I'm not trying to convince people to become believers or any, but for me, it's just okay. There's a fact that there was a kingdom called, you know, Judah, and a capital city named Jerusalem, and there was a dynasty, and King David was remembered as the founder of this dynasty. You don't have to believe the story of David and Goliath. I mean, it's just, but please don't remove David completely out of the picture just because you don't want him to be there. You know, if he's here, he's here, and that's it.
Right. Yeah, and that's what you're saying is what we've done with this exhibit. I mean, we have evidence based on, I guess, five or six scholars that most of them, well, all of them bar one, have come to their discovery of David or Solomon after the archaeological discoveries were made independent of the Bible, and then it's like, well, I've got 10th century and the Bible describes this here happening in this area, so why not put them together? But it wasn't like a prior thing that they had in their mind in any way. If I could, let's go just talk about your addition of what something you saw in your imaging that was never seen before from your imaging. You were able to locate a dot. And why is that important?
Yes, it's only a dot. So you could say it's a small contribution, but again, syntax is important. And we talked earlier about those vertical strokes that separate sentences, but dots separate words. And so I found this dot, which is again very helpful to see how many letters you have in that word. So we have then that's why I was able to say, you know, you have dalet, vav, dalet, and then the dot tells you it's the end of the word. It's important because without a dot, you can split words differently. Like, for instance, what they suggested in their Barak paper, if I remember correctly, is that vav at the end, which I read vav dalet at the end of David, they say it's actually the beginning of another sentence, and vav is a conjunction which means end. End this happened, end this. And of course, if you separate words at that point, right, then of course it's not David. It's a name that ends in the letter D, and then you start another word and something, and then David is gone, you know. So being able to separate words and sentences is key. And the fact that I located this dot as the end, so then it wouldn't make sense to start a sentence or word with vav, and then only one letter D, you know, and D, and that's the end of the word.
It doesn't exist.
So again, it doesn't work. It's impossible from a linguistic perspective. So the fact that there is this dot is a key to the solution because it tells us that this is not the beginning of a word or even the beginning of a sentence. It's actually the end of a word. And again, if you don't have that many words that end with vav dalet, and if you have a dalet before, then the only possible reading is David. And so this dot, even though it's only, you know, sometimes the minor details, you know, are important. You know, sometimes, you know, in the Bible, it tells you about, you know, if you add or remove a single, you know, letter, it makes a difference. In that case, I would say it's a bit the same as what you read in the Bible. Like if you have this dot, even the tiniest dot makes a big difference, and it was key in the present case.
And this is, again, very like the same as the tel dan stila. There's a dot before bet, and then there's a dot after the final dalet of David. And so you have this, what you discovered was that's basically the same thing that exists on the Mishnah Stela. So in terms of your contribution to the research of just this, the house of David, on this inscription, I know there's always going to be naysayers, but where do you feel like the middle of your epigrapha friends are on this inscription? Do they agree with you? Are they reticent to give their opinion regarding this, or are we reaching a point of consensus that, as best as we can, on the Mishnah Stela saying House of David?
Well, I would say that first, there aren't that many scholars who are able to discuss those topics because it's quite technical. So there aren't that many people who work on ancient Hebrew and Aramaic epigraphy. So there aren't that many people that I can talk to. Right. But yes, I mean, most of them were convinced. I mean, I showed the pictures. Some of them, they wanted me to show them, you know, the RTI imaging. We have a software with RTI. So I offer them even to go with them to the museum, to the to look at the actual stone itself. Even though, again, the squeeze is also a key piece in my investigation. No, I would say they're on, again, it's not a, the discovery itself, I didn't think it was such a strong discovery because we have the tel dan inscription where it's very clear. So even I myself, I really think my contribution is not that big because for me it was already clear that we have the house of David on the tel dan inscription. But of course, the fact that it's mentioned a second time at the same time period is very interesting because the fact that it's written by people from abroad, you know, the king of Moab, the king of Damascus. I mean, those people do not want us to believe in the Bible or
Right.
to believe in the God of the Bible. They are enemies. They are actually enemies of Israel. And even the enemies knew at the time that, you know, whoever is ruling in Jerusalem is of the house of David. So it tells us a lot about the fame and the fact that there's a clear hierarchy and dynasty in Jerusalem that is known even to the neighbors, even to the enemies. So in that regard, I think it's quite interesting that we would have two mentions of the house of David at about the same time.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. When we give tours of our exhibit here, we talk about the Mishnah Stela being a second evidence for the House of David. We have a bit of the back and forth, but from our perspective, I mean, it's as close as you're going to get from what we have available, being the squeeze at this point. So thank you so much for that, for sticking with it and just saying where the scientific evidence led you on this. So before we go, I want to just ask about this upcoming published inscriptions that have never been seen before by anybody else. Please tell me, you know, what these inscriptions are about, if you can, and perhaps where they're from as well.
So these Hebrew inscriptions, we have a collection of about 450 Hebrew inscriptions. They are in a private collection. They were unfortunately not found during official excavations, and it's always a shame because we lack so much information about the stratigraphy, the context. But we're happy that those inscriptions did not end up somewhere in bad hands, and that we are able to decipher them and to publish them. They are ostraca, which means that they are pottery shards, ancient pottery that were going to be thrown away, you know, and reused pottery shards were reused. It's a bit like recycling, you know, and writing on them, and they are used for daily life. So we have lists of things to buy, or have tabloids. We have small memos, small, you know, messages sent, especially in a military context. Someone giving orders to other people, or people reporting back to their superiors. So we have a glimpse of what was going on in the late kingdom of Judah. They date around 600 BCE, which means, and they are really interesting because they're not related to religion itself, but they tell us more about the reality of what was going on at the time, whether it is administration, tax, army, everything. And religion is, of course, present everywhere because people believed in God at the time. And so they would, you know, when they greet each other, they say, I bless you by God, and I wish you peace, and may God give you peace. So it's very interesting to see that how people talk about religion, even in when they talk about daily matters. Also, we have words in ancient Hebrew. So they use the language that they use is what we would call biblical Hebrew, except it's not from the Bible. So it means that biblical Hebrew was a real language, a living language at the time. And it helps us study this language as a living language and then look back at some of the passages from the Bible to better understand some of the verses from the Bible. There are some words there that we knew from the Bible, but we were not really sure of their meaning in the Hebrew Bible. And now, thanks to these new inscriptions, we have a better understanding of some of those verses in the Hebrew Bible, some of the traditions in the Hebrew Bible also. You know, sometimes biblical writers or prophets refer to some customs, and now we have nice parallels with the Book of Kings, the Book of Jeremiah as well. And we can see that people sometimes they swear, there's an inscription, someone who is late on delivering some goods or something says, I swear I will do it. And he swears by God, by two gods, actually, by Yahweh and by Bel. And Bel is a god from Babylon. And so it's a bit of a shock. It's like, what, you know, did they believe in two gods? And then when you read, you know, what, for instance, Prophet Jeremiah writes at the time, of course, he condemns people for idolatry, and, you know, so when the Bible says you shouldn't do that, it's because people were actually actually doing it. And that's why there had to be prophets to condemn. So basically, we see the other side, you know, of what we read in the Bible, which confirms a number of passages from the Bible. So I'm really excited to work on this collection of ancient Hebrew inscriptions. We've been working on it for years with André Lemaire, and hopefully the book will be out. We're almost done with the book, so maybe it will appear this year or next year at the latest, but it will be, I think, the most important discovery in ancient Hebrew for a long time. So we're really happy and privileged to work on these inscriptions.
Well, that sounds really exciting. I'm looking forward to getting into that. It's probably going to produce a lot of extra discussions between us two in the future, and I definitely look forward to that. So thank you very much, Professor Michael Langlois, for your time today, and more importantly, for your contribution to the studies of the Bible and the ancient Near East as well, where the Bible took place. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much to Professor Michael Langlois for the time you've taken to really enlighten us on ancient inscription, in particular the debate over the Mishnah Stele and whether it says the House of David. I think it's good and well that we can put that debate to rest now and say that we do have a second inscription that says the House of David, really adding supporting evidence to show that King David definitely was a king, and he was a king over a dynasty. If you like today's program, and you want to make sure you can read up more about the Stele and also the other evidence for the Kingdom of David and Solomon discovered, please go ahead and request our exhibit edition of Let the Stones Speak. This is about 130 plus pages, and it goes through the evidences that testify to the biblical account from David and Solomon's time, as much as archaeology can do in this study. If you'd like a copy of this, please go to our website, armstronginstitute.org, and you'll find a place on the front page where you can request a copy, or you can write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org, letters@armstronginstitute.org, and we'll make sure that you get a copy as soon as possible. Thanks very much for listening.